Welcome. Welcome to this special session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals being held at the University of Minnesota Law School. We are very grateful to the law school for hosting us here today. And we're also grateful to counsel for your participation in this different location. We're very happy to have the arguments here with the students. Today's arguments are being live streamed. An audio recording of the argument will be posted later on the Court of Appeals website. We have one case for oral argument this morning, and that case is A23-1593, State of Minnesota versus Daquan Christopher Savon, I apologize if I mispronounced that, Ledbetter, appellant, State of Minnesota respondent versus Mr. Ledbetter, appellant. Counsel, as you know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use it. At the start of your principal argument, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. We have this clock. Can both counsels see our clock? Yes, okay, great. And if I understand correctly, we have no warning indicator. All that happens is there's a beep at the end when it gets down to zero. So if you keep an eye on it, we will too. That's what you can expect here. With that, we are ready for appellant.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Assistant State Public Defender Julie Nelson, and I represent the appellant Daquan Ledbetter in his appeal from his convictions for aiding and abetting attempted first-degree premeditated murder. Mr. Ledbetter contends that the evidence is insufficient to sustain his convictions. This is a circumstantial evidence case, which means that this court must determine if the inferences that can be drawn from the circumstances proved supports a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt. Mr. Ledbetter contends that there is an alternative reasonable hypothesis other than attempted first-degree premeditated murder, and that is that the shooting was the result of an impulsive and reckless overreaction to the taunting of by the other group. Specifically, Mr. Ledbetter challenges the three elements of the charged offense, and that is that there was no specific intent, no one acted with premeditation, and Mr. Ledbetter did not aid and abet anybody in the commission of the charged offenses. Unless this court would prefer that I start elsewhere, I'm going to start with the idea or the concept element of specific intent. Attempted first-degree murder is a specific intent crime. Generally, this means that the state must prove that the defendant had the specific intent to cause or attempt to cause the death of a particular person or another. Here, however, the state, with all the authority and power vested in it, chose to prosecute Mr. Ledbetter under a stricter theory of liability. The state chose to prove that Mr. Ledbetter, acting as a principal or an accomplice, attempted to specifically cause the deaths of each of the four named victims. And importantly, that is exactly how the jury was instructed. Now, it is not this court's job to second guess how the state chose to prosecute this case.
So counsel, your argument relies on the jury instructions. Because we know the statute permits intending to shoot the named victim or another. I didn't see it in the briefing, but you might be familiar with a series of non-precedential decisions by this court that cite a United States Supreme Court case, non-precedential to us, that the sufficiency of the evidence is not measured according to how the jury was instructed, even if instructed erroneously, Sacchio, but according to the actual elements of the crime. Could you be prepared to address that question? I know that no one cited that case, but I think you might be familiar with it.
I believe that Your Honor might be talking about State v. Armstrong.
That's one case. State v. Smith was another.
Okay. I am ready to discuss that. I did read State v. Armstrong. And I saw the part where this court was opining that perhaps the cases like, State v. Lloyd, a Fry Roofing Company, which was decided like 50 years ago, where the Supreme Court said that The sufficiency of the evidence to sustain a conviction is reviewed in the context of the law as instructed and not by the statute. And this court questions whether that is still good law. I have several comments about that. First, there is nothing from the Supreme Court that says it's not. Secondly, the cases that this court cited in State v. Armstrong, and I read them all, State v. Davenport, State v. Belayden, State v. Peterson, I read them all, and here's what struck me about those cases, is that they do not, you are correct, the court is correct, they apply the statute against sufficiency of the evidence challenges, but there is no challenge to the jury instructions in any of those cases. So to me, that strongly supports the idea that in those cases, the statute matched up with the elements of the offense. We don't have that here exactly. And the reason why it's different here is because the state made the jury instructions an element on, or raised the issue of jury instructions on appeal, saying we don't need to follow them. We can simply apply transferred intent. That is not the case. This is a very different situation. I think Your Honor just mentioned Machio v. United States, and that's one where even if the instruction was wrong, they would still apply the statute. But in Machio and in Armstrong, in both of those cases, the problem was that the district court had added an element to the offenses that were being charged. They added an unnecessary element, and that's very different than what happened here. An element hasn't been added to the offense of aiding and abetting first degree attempted premeditated murder. It did not include the idea or the doctrine of transferred intent, and that's a big difference. The other problem, sorry.
Oh, you can say the other problem.
Sorry, the other problem with simply applying the doctrine of transferred intent, well, actually, there are two. First, this would require this court to make an unprecedented holding that on appeal, the reviewing courts can apply the doctrine of transferred intent even when it was not even though the jury was not instructed on it.
So what would be wrong with that if what we do is measure the sufficiency of the evidence? Whether the state, or you know, another way we look at it is whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt. How does that impact an appellate court deciding whether the evidence is sufficient to prove A, B, C element?
Because the court then would be putting itself in the place of all of the jurors and making findings that the jurors were neither instructed on nor found. And it would also open up the idea that even if the state, and again, this was the state's choice to prosecute it this way. So it's not for this court to go back and say, oh, you should have done it differently to sustain your convictions. That's what the state chose to do. Hold their feet to the fire here.
In the amended complaint, they did charge of another.
In the complaint, yes.
And so then why wouldn't that be in the U.S. Supreme Court case in that realm of match the evidence, the elements?
Because the elements that were provided to the jury simply said that the state had to prove that my client aided and abetted in the specific murder of each individual victim and not the other. And the jury was instructed to find those elements beyond a reasonable doubt. They are not instructed to decide whether or not the offense matches up with the statute. They have to decide whether or not it matches up with the elements as they are instructed, and they did not here. And the state concedes as much in its brief, and I think that's at page 13, where it says that, find it very quickly here, where the respondent says, he concedes, the evidence does not unerringly show that each bullet fired by Mr. Ledbetter was intended for one of the four victims. That's what the respondent's brief at 13. They concede that there was not a specific intent shown here for those.
It seems to me like the entirety of the argument hinges upon the premise that in order for specific, in this specific intent crime, there must be proof that either the principal or the principal, whoever that is, whether it's Mr. Ledbetter or one of the other two shooters, intended to kill one of the victims, one of the four victims. Is that right?
Each of the four victims. Each separately. Of the four,
okay, and by name, and there's no and it, and
or by target at least.
By target.
So they, I mean, I would concede we don't know whether they knew who exactly they were shooting, but they had to know that they were shooting that person. That was their intent. And this is the whole idea why we have transferred intent to begin with, is a lot of times someone is shooting somebody is going to miss and hit somebody else instead. And we want to make sure that that intent to shoot, excuse me, Judge Frisch, to shoot you, I shoot Judge Smith instead.
Thanks.
I apologize, but I missed, that I will still be held responsible.
So let's take this into, so you're saying that the your theory here, that the state limited its case, does that apply also to the aiding and abetting liability issue?
This offense?
The state, are you arguing, in your aiding and abetting challenge,
mm-hmm.
you argue you know, that the defendant, the appellant didn't have knowledge of what his alleged accomplice is intended to do and didn't take a substantial step toward that, right? But as part of your argument here, I'm trying to understand the impact of the jury instructions and what you're arguing about the sufficiency review is that the state also limited itself, unless we know. We have three shooters who shot four people, and you're saying that the state had to prove that either he for the principal or even as an accomplice had to prove that the other two, the driver and Mr. Garth,
mm-hmm.
that they had a specific intent to shoot the people they shot. For all we know who was shot,
right,
and we know who shot,
right,
and you're saying that the state had to prove specifically what was in the mind of the principal, if he's the principal or as an accomplice, the other two, as to who they intended to shoot.
That is correct.
So and they could all, theoretically, if the state limited it that way, none is proved guilty because, you know, they rained gunfire down on the group and hit four, unless they prove which ones they intended to shoot and that it wasn't an accident, they meant someone else. State's out of luck.
Exactly. And let me explain this a little bit further so that, yeah.
That seems novel to me.
Well, here's, right, look at it this way. Let's just say, let's, conceding for the purpose of this very part of my argument, that Morris or Garth had this very specific intention to shoot and kill the four named victims. That still doesn't prove aiding and abetting for my client because we don't know who my client was shooting at. So if all the four victims are over there and my client shooting in that direction, his shooting did not impact or help, did not aid and abet in the shooting of the four victims. But,
if he had knowledge that that Garth and Morris intended to go shoot people,
mm-hmm.
either those who got, in fact, ended up the victims or other people in that group that they shot toward.
Why
does it matter, like, who he shot?
Because this is a specific intent case. They have to have the specific intent to, because they do. But my client still has to aid and abet. And this is a weird aiding and abetting case, right? I mean, usually when we're talking about aiding and abetting, we'd be talking about my client provided the guns or the ammunition, or he drove them to the place or drove them away from the place. This is a weird aiding and abetting case. But at the very least, we need to know who my client was shooting at in order to determine whether he was aiding.
Yeah, what?
Because how is he aiding and abetting his co-defendants in shooting people over here if he's shooting over there?
To cover?
Yeah.
For Morris and Garth?
There were no other circumstances proved. There were no other guns.
Well, there were no guns from the other side, right? But
right.
He doesn't know that. He doesn't know that. I mean, we watched the video 8 million times and dissected every inch of that video. And it seems that they're all moving at the same direction and everything is happening so quickly. As soon as the first shots ring out, he ducks and then he's up and he's shooting. And it doesn't seem like there's any hesitation other than this concerted effort to attack this group who is taunting them.
And I would agree with that to an extent. I think that Ledbetter was standing back and kind of like, what's going on? We're leaving. Are we going? And then he sees Garth go towards the group and start shooting. And then he ducks. and then gets up and starts shooting right away. But compare this, I think this might help, compare this to the other charges with which Mr. Ledbetter was convicted, and that's aiding and abetting second degree assault, harm with a deadly weapon. Harm, that is a general intent crime. So in that case, all three of them are firing at the group. It doesn't matter who they intended to harm. Four people were harmed. And in that situation, we would agree that my client was aiding and abetting. But you must have the specific intent if they're going to charge it as aiding and abetting attempted first-degree premeditated murder. And even if you can't get, even if you say that that's, that that the specific intent isn't necessary, certainly premeditation is. And the state had two theories on premeditation. One, that this was all planned out in advance, and this they were bringing firearms to a fist fight, which the evidence shows that was not what this was about. This was not in reaction to that. This was about a taunting that they were responding to. They were leaving. And here's what happened. So they get there. Morris pulls up, gets out, goes and meets his friends, and they right away start going back to the sedan to leave. They hear the taunting. They kind of turn around. Garth's looking at them. From the time that Garth pulls his firearm out of his pocket and actually fires is 9 seconds. 9 seconds to form premeditation to kill Nicholas Jones, Brian Jones, Darius Vannable, and Laser Jones. In 9 seconds, he needed to formulate all of that. Now, I understand that I'm about to run out of time, if I can have one more minute, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I understand that an appreciable amount of time can be a small amount. I would ask this case to compare this, excuse me, ask this court to compare this to State v. Barshaw, where the defendant was, it was a 50 seconds. The Supreme Court said that was enough time to formulate premeditation. But in that situation, Barshaw was following the victim for a period of time over that 50 seconds, tracing them, tracking him down, then shoots him, pauses, and shoots him again. I would also say if there were only four victims, there weren't the 10 or 15 people, but just the four, maybe the state wins then. But not under the circumstances of this. This was chaos, and we ask you to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Question, if I may.
Sure.
Why is it not enough to look at where the victims were shot? That's something that the Supreme Court has said can be evidence of premeditation and intent. So one victim was shot twice, once in the head and once in the neck. Another victim was shot once in the chest, and another victim was shot once in the head. I mean, all of that seems like it's shooting to kill.
If they were indeed, if the defendants were indeed shooting at those four victims, but the circumstances proved, again, this was chaotic. Who were they shooting at? It was indiscriminate shooting. It didn't matter who they had hit. They had to have the specific intent to hit those four people.
So the indiscriminate sinks it for the state, but then you say, oh, it was transferred intent. Arguably, they're shooting at someone else and happened to hit.
We don't know what they were doing. I'm not saying it's transferred intent. The only way transferred intent applies is if that instruction is given to the jury.
No, I get that.
Okay.
I get that. But I think you're pointing to, who knows who they, when they shot all those times, 28 times, and four people are hit, that the state has to prove specifically who they were shooting at.
Under the circumstances of this case, the way they chose to prosecute it, if they had chosen to expand their theory of liability, then they could have said or another, and we might be here on a different issue. But this was the state's choice. This is what they chose to do. It is not for this court to second guess that.
I have a question. Oh, go ahead, please. You mentioned something before Judge Schmidt and Judge Smith were asking you some questions. You indicated that if there were 10 victims, then maybe the state wins, but this was chaos. I don't understand why that circumstance is any different. I mean, 28 shots rang out. It was by dumb luck that it didn't hit more than four people, quite frankly. So why does it matter that there were only four victims as opposed to 10 victims for the result to be different in this case?
I wonder if perhaps you misunderstood what I said, and let me clarify. What I said was if there had been only four people in the group, there were no others that could have been hit, then I think that the inference that can be drawn from those circumstances is that
was the
they were shooting at those four guys. They had a specific intent. But when you have 10 to 15 people, who are you shooting at? We don't know, and the state didn't prove that.
Thank you. Good? Okay. Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And counsel for respondent.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. Reading the briefs, it struck me that the parties agree on a very important thing, which is that Exhibit 3, the video of the shooting, is very important. It's very important because it shows premeditation and it shows aiding and abetting. And I'll start with premeditation, and there are six main facts I want to point to on premeditation. But just as an overview, Exhibit 3 shows this was not just some spontaneous, like, boom, 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 it's over shooting. We have six key things here. First, appellant intentionally brought a gun to what was supposed to be a fistfight. Second, he kept the gun hidden in his pocket while he's walking towards this other group. If he had pulled it out, they would have seen it. They could have scattered earlier than they did. Third, and this is very important, and Judge Fisher, I was glad to hear that you've watched this 8 million times, because I think I have too, frame by frame. And if you watch the video, right before the shooting, appellant transfers the cigarette from his right hand to his left hand. Forgive me for this, but that's the smoking gun. He is preparing to shoot by moving the cigarette. No one smokes with their non-dominant hand. He shoots with that hand. He's getting ready to shoot with the gun that he still has hidden in his pocket.
But I think the question is, shoot for what purpose? And to what end? I mean, right. That's the focus of Ms. Nelson's argument, that there's an absence of proof of specific intent to kill these four victims in this particular case. So help us out there.
Okay.
How do we get across the finish line in that?
Okay, I'm going to make a mental note that I have three more facts on premeditation, because she is challenging that too. Because I think her argument is, this just happened so quick, it was 9 seconds. There couldn't have been premeditation, but you have everything that leads up to it. And if you don't mind, I'll just do those three quick and get to that. The other facts are, he hid behind this car, and then he makes a conscious decision to stand up and start shooting. He could have stayed down where it was safe. You are aware of the case law that says that premeditation can happen almost instantaneously. Well, he made a conscious decision to get out of safety, stand up, and start shooting. And then, this is number five, he shoots not once, but six times. It's clear that a pause between shots can be premeditation. Well, here you have six shots. Over the course of those six, he has plenty of time to think about it and change his mind. And then six, you have the fact that while he's shooting, he's still advancing towards this group. He's not holding his ground. He's not backing away. He's going after them by walking towards them as he's shooting, not one time, but six times. So all that shows there is plenty of time for premeditation. Again, the case law says premeditation can be almost instantaneous. I think the more interesting question here is the question of aiding and abetting and the specific intent. And I think it's answered by the jury instructions. And if you look at page 655 of the transcript, one of the instructions that was given, because these are obviously given multiple times for multiple victims, is if the defendant intentionally aided another in committing a crime, the defendant is also guilty of any other crime the person commits while trying to commit the intended crime if the other crime is reasonably foreseeable. So even if the other two shooters are not aiming at these four particular people, it is reasonably foreseeable that they will hit other people. And he is therefore responsible for that, no matter what their intent was, no matter what his intent was, as long as intent was to aid and abet. And I've got five key facts on that, but I pause for questions on that.
I mean, it seems like that would be helpful if second degree intentional or unintentional murder were charged, which it was not. I think that we're hamstrung by the charging decision here, a first degree premeditated murder, aiding and abetting. So how do we get across the, I'll return to my original question. How do we get across the finish line? And there's a disconnect between the evidence that was presented at trial and the intent to kill these four victims that were struck by gunfire.
Well, you have to have premeditation, and I've already covered that.
Yes.
And so all three of them premeditate, or at least he premeditates this shooting.
Premeditate for a shooting, but I mean, right. We're talking about an intentional planned murder of four specific people. So there's a bridge there that we're trying to to cross.
But I think the key thing here is that he doesn't have to have intended to shoot these four people. He just has to intend to aid his friends in whatever they're trying to do. And anything that's reasonably foreseeable as part of what his friends are doing that he's aiding, he's responsible for.
And is it aiding the friends in whatever they're trying to do, but or aiding their friends in their plan to kill these four people?
I think it's aiding the friends in their plan to shoot at this group. But even if the friends' plan is not to shoot ABCD, but to shoot EFG, shooting ABCD is still reasonably foreseeable if you're shooting at a big group of people. So under this jury instruction, he's responsible for anything reasonably foreseeable from helping his friends do this shooting.
But when it comes to the intent instruction, the court was very clear that it was acted with the intent to kill Nicholas Jones, acted with the intent to kill Brian Jones. It listed each individual victim, and there was no of another in there. And that missing of another seems critical to the case.
Well, and I think that's where the reasonably foreseeable is really important here, because it's reasonably foreseeable that if you are intending to kill someone else, but you kill this person, that can happen when you're shooting into a crowd like that. The way I've read appellant's argument, and maybe I'm wrong here, is more that just he would, well, first of all, contrary to appellant's reply brief, appellant does say in the initial brief on page 27, the three men were operating independently from another. So that's the argument. These three are, it's just chaos. They're operating independently. He makes a split second decision. He's not aiding anybody. But here are the five key facts on the aiding. Again, while his friends are approaching these people with guns, he does the same thing, and he too does not display the gun, which again would have allowed the other crowd to scatter. So he's aiding them by not warning the other crowd as he's approaching with a gun. He's also aiding his friends because he's walking with them towards this group of people, and they're not clumped together for safety. They're kind of spreading out different angles to shoot at. Also, he aids them by deciding when he's in safety behind this car to pop up and start shooting. If the other group's goal is to shoot people in this crowd, by him shooting too, he's helping them achieve that goal. And it doesn't matter who the other ones are aiming for, because anything that's reasonably foreseeable is on him. So then the fourth fact in terms of the aiding is he shoots not once, but six times. Again, that's aiding this attempt by the others to shoot whoever they can in this crowd. And then fifth, again, he's shooting while still advancing towards this other group.
Unfortunately, I can't pull up the aiding and abetting statute right now. I've lost my Wi-Fi. All right, I'm a little confused because it doesn't strike me. I mean, that's essentially the felony murder rule, that while committing a felony, it was reasonably foreseeable that another crime was committed.
Well,
right? And I mean, or at least that's how I think about it. Isn't that I don't recall this being the theory of the state's briefing, and still don't the other crime that's is Garth and Morris's premeditated intentional first degree murder. So I'm not sure how that reasonably foreseeable ends gets you to where you need to go. I mean, if the idea is he has to aid and abet first degree premeditated intentional murder, how can you say it's foreseeable that they would have done it and we don't actually have to, state doesn't actually have to prove that they did it?
Well, I mean, there's no question here that they shot at these people. So the question really just comes down to, do we have to prove that either he was aiming at one of these four people or that one of his two accomplices was aiming specifically at one or all of these four people? And that's where the reasonably foreseeable language, which again is straight out of the jury instruction, which appellant has never claimed was erroneous, applies here. Reasonably foreseeable also applies in felony murder, but applies generally to aiding and abetting. So if you aid and abet your buddy in doing a bank robbery and you all bring guns and your buddy shoots one of the tellers, you're guilty of murder because it was reasonably foreseeable that that would happen. Even if you didn't intend it, even if you didn't know they intended that, you just have to have knowledge. And here he has knowledge of the guns and everything else, and you have to aid and abet. And even if you're the getaway driver, you're aiding and abetting. And under this language...
Okay, so what, in that case, what does the state have to prove about the crime that took place that the other person did? You said, you know, bank robbery, and you aid and abet, and your accomplice kills somebody, murders someone.
Yeah.
Okay, what is the murder that needs to be proved?
Well,
in order to prove that not just it's foreseeable you might murder someone, but do you not have to prove the elements of that murder?
You do. And so okay. Here we had to prove an attempted premeditated murder.
First degree murder.
Yes. Well, that's where the premeditation comes in.
Right.
And we did prove premeditation based on the five facts, six or maybe
so you
plus.
You do have to get to. It's not just is it foreseeable someone might commit first degree murder. You have to prove that, in fact, the other people did attempt first degree murder. Correct.
Well, not under the reasonably foreseeable language, which again is straight out of the jury instructions here.
I mean, straight out of the jury instructions is sort of neither here nor there. I mean, it should be tied to a case.
Well,
they're not authority, right?
No, that's true. But appellant hasn't claimed the jurors are insufficiently or erroneously instructed here. And there's plenty of cases that talk about you're responsible for anything that reasonably foreseeably happens while you are aiding another.
Are you suggesting that the state does not have to prove that anyone, when you're going after aiding and abetting, under your theory, that anyone committed attempted first-degree murder?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean,
the state has to prove someone attempted first-degree murder.
And they did when they shot into this crowd 28 times. It was premeditated, as I've already argued. And when you're shooting at a crowd, I mean, an important principle
here. Why does that help so much to say it's reasonably? I think what our questions focus on is, and I think what the appellant is arguing is, the state failed to prove attempted first-degree murder by any of them, any of the three, because this jury instruction wrongly excluded or another. That's what I am understanding the argument here.
Well, first of all, again, we're dealing with attempt here. So if you shoot at someone and miss, you're still guilty of attempt. And if it happens to hit somebody else, well, then you're responsible for that person, arguably, too. The state arguably could have charged attempt for everyone they shot at who wasn't even hit, because an attempt doesn't require a hit. They're shooting 28 times into this crowd. They're not shooting up in the air. They're not shooting into the ground. 28 times at this crowd that is fleeing, a crowd that has no gun. There wasn't any sort of self-defense element here. So the key fact here is, you know, the premeditation with everything that occurs leading up to the shooting. And then you have all the things he did to help the goal here. And again, you've got the reasonably foreseeable principle here. And I think transfer intent also does apply here. And I'll talk about that quickly in the time I have left, because there's been talk about this U.S. Supreme Court case. It's Musacchio. It's not an old case. It's 2016. Judge Smith, you cited it in your decision in the Smith case in 2020. And it basically says when you're looking at sufficiency, you look at the elements. You don't look at how the jury was instructed. It doesn't matter if there was an extra element or if the jurors forgot an element. And that makes sense. In the interest of justice, we just want to know, did this person commit this crime? It doesn't matter what happened with the jury instructions, because under sufficiency, you can't do another trial. So if the jury instructions were messed up, but there was sufficient evidence here, he shouldn't walk. And there isn't any claim here of trial error that would get him a new trial. He's just claiming, even though transfer intent exists as a doctrine, you can't apply it here. And I'm not aware of any case that supports that. And Musacchio goes directly against that.
Are you aware of any case that would support the theory that when of another is not instructed, that you can affirm on a transferred intent theory?
Well, I'm not aware of any case law going either way on that issue. But I think that the reasonably foreseeable doctrine language here is critical here, because if you shoot at someone in a crowd, it's reasonably foreseeable that you'll hit someone else. You don't have to have the for another language, because you're responsible for any crimes that are reasonably foreseeable when your buddies are trying to shoot people and there's other people around. I think
is there any evidence in this record that would show intent to kill these four specific victims?
Well, yes, I think in that you intend the natural and probable consequences of your actions. That is a well-established principle. And if you're shooting into a crowd of people, you are intending to kill whoever you hit in that crowd, because you're not shooting into the air. You're not doing a warning shot.
But that goes to transferred intent again, right? That goes to the of another. So if you're shooting into a crowd of people and you're intending to kill person A, but you shoot person B, that's the of another.
Well,
so I'm wondering, is there any evidence that they intended to kill A, B, C, D, those four victims?
I'm not actually sure you even need transfer intent in a situation like this, where everyone's in a crowd and it's not some sort of completely separate, unrelated, or you know, not close thing. It's very clear under Minnesota law, jurors can presume you intended the natural and probable consequences of your actions. And if you shoot into a crowd, we don't have to prove you knew any of them. We don't have to prove that you were aiming at A, B, C, or D. You were shooting into the crowd, and you were intending to hit whoever your bullet hit in that crowd.
But that's a general intent to kill. And here it's specific intent to kill. That's a difference in, you know, what was charged. And the first degree specific intent to kill on premeditation is I intend to kill that individual.
Well, if
okay,
I
go ahead.
I mean, they specifically intended to kill whoever they could hit in that crowd because they were shooting into the crowd. And the natural and probable consequences of that is to hit whoever you're shooting, who's ever in that crowd.
But isn't that general intent? Like there's a crowd of people and I'm shooting at this crowd of people intending to kill somebody. Specific intent is I'm intending to kill that specific person. And at least that's the way the jury was instructed of I intended to kill or the defendant intended to kill this specific person.
Well, Your Honor, and this is sort of a complicated scenario. And I think the fact that we have an aiding and abetting charge here and we don't just have appellant shooting and we can't prove who he hit is what really is critical here, because it was reasonably foreseeable that if his friends were going to shoot into a crowd, they might hit the people who they weren't intending to hit. And I think that's really what it comes down to. And I think, again, you have to apply a transferred intent here. There's no case law that says you don't apply it based on the jury instructions or even based on the charging language. You look at the elements of the crime and you look at this doctrine that clearly exists, and under Musascio and the cases from this court that have cited it, it applies here.
I'm going to ask one question. The theory of the appellant as a principal in aiding, an attempted first-degree murder, does it matter that there's no, I mean, I think of transferred intent basically, you know, shooting the person or another, but you still shot the person who is the victim. Does it matter that we can't tell, that the jury couldn't tell, state couldn't tell, whether he in fact shot any of these people?
No.
He may not have shot any of them.
Right, and that's where transferred intent comes in. As long as he was shooting at somebody in this crowd, the intent transfers to whoever he might have been aiming at, if he was aiming at anybody, not just at the crowd. So that's where transfer intent is important.
I mean, transfer intent, I would think, would make sense when he hits someone, and it doesn't matter where he's aiming, he in fact hits someone. That's how I think of transferred intent. He actually shot someone, even though he meant something else. But what we don't know is whether he actually shot someone.
Right, but again, this is an attempt crime, so it doesn't
matter. Is it because it's an attempt crime that doesn't matter?
Right, because we don't have to prove he actually shot these people as long as he attempted to shoot them or attempted to shoot others, and then the intent transfers over there.
So again, we get to, I mean, the or another is essentially a statutory expression of transferred intent, right?
Right.
So it's just that you're saying we should look at what the statute says and not be limited to what the jury instruction said.
Under Musascio, that's correct. And I think you don't have to reach the whether he was guilty as a principal anyway, because he's guilty as an aider and abettor. The only way you can challenge that is by arguing no premeditation, no knowledge, or no intent to aid. And I think I've covered all three of those today.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Few things to talk about here. This is just a minor fact. My client only shot 5 times, not 6, or whatever that means. Judge Smith, you were 100% correct when you said that it is not reasonably foreseeable, but this is not a reasonably foreseeable offense, first degree attempted murder, when he was committing an assault. And I think one of the things the way this court should look at it is when Garth and Morris started firing, they could have simply been trying to scare them. And that would be assault fear. And a reasonable foreseeable result would be assault harm. A reasonable foreseeable result from second degree assault harm is not attempted first degree premeditated murder. It's way too much of a stretch there. Mr. Raggetts depended very much on the jury instructions that talk about the foreseeability. I just want to add one more thing in here about that, and I lost it, but that is exactly that.
To be honest, counsel, I mean, that jury instruction was not the focus of the briefing. Okay. And so I wasn't focused on that particular jury instruction. Was that instructed in the context of the assault charge?
It was instructed in the context of first degree murder.
Okay.
But then the very next paragraph is, however, to be guilty of aiding and abetting first degree murder, the co-defendants had to have committed that offense.
All right.
So it's not just enough that it's reasonably foreseeable. And again, I would argue all day long that first degree attempted premeditated murder is not a reasonably foreseeable result of assault, fear, or harm, which is what I think that what the three men were doing. I don't think premeditation was proved. I think that that is one way to view the video. The other way to look at it, there is a reasonable alternative inference, and that is that the men were leaving. I think that when they kept getting
told. How can you say that the men were leaving when they're all walking towards the other group and they have, and he, Mr. Ledbetter, has moved the cigarette into his left hand and is pulling the gun out of his waistband and approaching behind the other two shooters and then shooting immediately after? I don't understand how we get to.
Prior to that, they were going to the car to leave. This was not some sort of pre-planned thing to do. They weren't going to shoot them. They got there.
Isn't it sufficient to formulate the plan after they come back to the car and then they go towards the group? I mean, why isn't that a plan to go together?
Because at that point, because they didn't all go together, first of all. Excuse me. They did not all go together. Garth went. He pulls his gun out and he starts walking. Then Morris follows about 5 seconds later. My client's kind of hanging back. I think you could infer that he's looking at, like, what's going on? Are they just going to go scare him or getting out of here or what? Then he goes and follows them. He was absolutely surprised by the shooting because he ducked by the sedan as soon as the firing started. And then he came up, and that was a very rash decision on his part to start shooting. But again, we're talking about formulating premeditation in 9 seconds and to specifically to kill those four individuals.
But when he's walking for, I mean, there is case law that says premeditation can be formed between pulling trigger,
mm-hmm.
right? And yep. So 9 seconds is a lot longer than between pulling the trigger. And so he's walking with his gun out and starts shooting. And then your client ducks down. Shooting's already going on, then pops up and starts shooting too. So
sure.
It seems like there's plenty of time here, based on what the case law says, for premeditation.
And I would respectfully disagree. I think that under the circumstances, because we have to look at all the circumstances that are proved in this case, so I would respectfully disagree with that. But I would say that it still would require that either Garth or Morris had the specific intent to kill those four named individuals, and the state simply has not proved that because we don't know who they were aiming at. And it's not enough, regardless as how many times Mr. Ragus want to say they were just firing into the crowd and that's okay, that doesn't do it.
But why not? If they, I mean, frankly, I don't know, if you have three shooters who say, all right, they take however many seconds you think is enough, five, and says, let's go light up this crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And they go and they hit four people, that the state would have to prove, well, they really meant to hit those four. I mean, I understand, like, assuming that they have to be held to, you know, that these four people. I mean, why? What's wrong with the argument? They intended to hit and kill whomever they could. And they don't need to be guy in a white T-shirt and blue shorts.
Can I take a moment to answer, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Because that's the way the state chose to prosecute the case, and that was the instruction that was given to the jury.
It's or another, it's like we intend to kill as many as we can get.
But that wasn't how the jury was instructed.
Well,
they were instructed that they intended to kill these four people.
But if those four people are among the group that they intended to get, like, why does it matter which one they happen to? I think that's a slightly different argument than they really meant this person, instead got these guys. They mean to get them all. That's the argument that I sort of heard, and they ended up getting four.
But that wasn't the argument that was made or argued to the jury, and we still don't have evidence. The state never proved that there was evidence that they were shooting at all 10 of them or 15 of them. They were shooting into the crowd. We don't know who they were shooting at. And therefore, the only way for this court to affirm is to imply the transferred intent and doctrine. It would be an unprecedented holding, and it would not be supported by the Supreme Court case law as it is right now. So we respectfully request that you reverse these convictions.
Thank you.
I have one more question.
Oh, if
I may.
Sorry, my apologies.
Under your theory, the state's case would have been stronger had they charged 10 or 15 attempted first-degree murders.
That's one possibility, and they didn't. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you very much, both of you, for your very helpful briefing and oral arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time period. And with that, we are adjourned.